18. Mid-morning. Hodges is in court and on best behavior. Holly would be proud. He answers the questions posed by the bald beater's attorney with crisp succinctness. The attorney gives him plenty of opportunity to be argumentative, and although this was a trap Hodges sometimes fell into during his detective days, he avoids it now. Linda Salvers is driving her pale, silent daughter home from school, where she will give Tina a glass of ginger ale to settle her stomach and then put her to bed. She is finally ready to ask Tina what she knows about the mystery money, but not until the girl feels better. The afternoon will be time enough, and she should make Pete a part of that conversation when he gets home from school. It will be just the three of them, and probably that's best. Tom and a group of his real estate clients are touring an office complex recently vacated by IBM 50 miles north of the city and won't be back until 7, even later if they stop for dinner on the return trip. Pete is in Period 3 Advanced Physics, and although his eyes are trained on Mr. Norton, who is rhapsodizing about the Higgs boson and the CERN Large Hadron Collider in Switzerland, the mind behind those eyes is much closer to home. He is going over a script for this afternoon's meeting yet again, and reminding himself that just because he has a script doesn't mean Halliday will follow it. Halliday has been in this business a long time, and he's probably been skirting the edges of the law for much of it. Pete is just a kid, and it absolutely will not do to forget that. He must be careful and allow for his inexperience. He must think before he speaks every time. Above all, he must be brave. He tells Halliday, "Half a loaf is better than none, but in a world of want, even a single slice is better than none. I'm offering you 3 dozen slices. You need to think about that." He tells Halliday, "I'm not going to be anyone's birthday fuck. You better think about that too." He tells Halliday, "If you think I'm bluffing, go on and try me. But if you do, we both wind up with nothing." He thinks, "If I can hold my nerve, I can get out of this. And I will hold it. I will. I have to." Morris Bellamy parks the stolen Subaru 2 blocks from Bugshit Manor and walks back. He lingers in the doorway of a secondhand store to make sure Ellis McFarlane isn't in the vicinity, then scurries to the miserable building and plods up the 9 flights of stairs. Both elevators are busted today, which is par for the course. He scrambles random clothes into one of the tough totes and then leaves his crappy room for the last time. All the way down to the first corner, his back feels hot, his neck as stiff as an ironing board. He carries 1 tough tote in each hand, and they seem to weigh 100 pounds apiece. He keeps waiting for McFarlane to call his name, to step out from beneath a shadowed awning and ask him why he's not at work, to ask him where he thinks he's going, to ask him what he's got in those bags, and then to tell him he's going back to prison, do not pass go, do not collect $200. Morris doesn't relax until Bugshit Manor is out of sight for good. Tom Salvers is walking his little pack of real estate agents through the empty IBM facility, pointing out the various features and encouraging them to take pictures. They're all excited by the possibilities. Come the end of the day, his surgically repaired legs and hips will ache like all the devils of hell, but for the time being, he's feeling fine. This abandoned office and manufacturing complex could be a big deal for him. Life is finally turning around. Jerome has popped into Hodges' office to surprise Holly, who squeals with joy when she sees him, then with apprehension when he seizes her by the waist and swings her around as he likes to do with his little sister. They talk for an hour or more, catching up, and she gives him her views on the Salvers affair. She's happy when Jerome takes her concerns about the moleskin notebook seriously, and happier still to find out he has seen 22 Jump Street. They drop the subject of Pete Salvers and discuss the movie at great length, comparing it to others in Jonah Hill's filmography. Then they move on to a discussion of various computer apps. Andrew Halliday is the only one not occupied. First editions no longer matter to him, nor do young waiters in tight black pants. Oil and water are the same as wind and air to him now. he's sleeping the big sleep in a patch of congealed blood, drawing flies. 19. 11 o'clock. It's 80 degrees in the city, and the radio says the mercury's apt to touch 90 before subsiding. Got to be global warming, people tell each other. Morris cruises past the Birch Street wreck twice and is happy, though not really surprised, to see it's as deserted as ever, just an empty brick box baking under the sun. No police, no security cars. Even the crow has departed for cooler environs. He circles the block, noting that there's now a trim little Ford Focus parked in the driveway of his old house. Mr. or Mrs. Saubers has knocked off early. Hell, maybe both of them. It's nothing to Morris. He heads back to the wreck, and this time turns in, going around to the rear of the building and parking in what he's now begun to think of as his spot. He's confident that he's unobserved, but it's still a good idea to do this quickly. He carries his bags to the window he's forced up and drops them to the basement floor, where they land with a flat clap and twin puffs of dust. He takes a quick look around, then slides feet first through the window on his stomach. A wave of dizziness runs through his head as he takes his first deep breath of the cool, musty air. He staggers a little and puts his arms out for balance. It's the heat, he thinks. You've been too busy to realize it, but you're dripping with sweat. Also, you ate no breakfast. Both true, but the main thing is simpler and self-evident. He's not as young as he used to be, and it's been years since the physical exertions of the dye house. He's got to pace himself. Over by the furnace are a couple of good-sized cartons with kitchen supplies printed on the sides. Morris sits down on one of these until his heartbeat slows and the dizziness passes. Then he unzips the tote with Andy's little automatic inside, tucks the gun into the waistband of his pants at the small of his back, and blouses his shirt over it. He takes $100 of Andy's money, just in case he runs into any unforeseen expenses, and leaves the rest for later. He'll be back here this evening, may even spend the night. It sort of depends on the kid who stole his notebooks, and what measures Morris needs to employ in order to get them back. Whatever it takes, cocksucker, he thinks. Whatever it takes. Right now, it's time to move on. As a younger man, he could have pulled himself out of that basement window easily, but not now. He drags over one of the kitchen supplies cartons. It's surprisingly heavy, probably some old busted appliance inside, and uses it as a step. 5 minutes later, he's headed for Andrew Halliday Rare Editions, where he will park his old pal's car in his old pal's space and then spend the rest of the day soaking up the air conditioning and waiting for the young notebook thief to arrive. James Hawkins, indeed, he thinks. 20. 2:15. Hodges, Holly, and Jerome are on the move, headed for their positions around Northfield High. Hodges out front, Jerome on the corner of Westfield Street, Holly beyond the high school's auditorium on Garner Street. When they are in position, they'll let Hodges know. In the bookshop, on Lacemaker Lane, Morris adjusts his tie, turns the hanging sign from closed to open, and unlocks the door. He goes back to the desk and sits down. If a customer should come in to browse, not terribly likely at such a slack time of the day, but possible, he will be happy to help. If there's a customer here when the kid arrives, he'll think of something. Improvise. His heart is beating hard, but his hands are steady. The shakes are gone. I am a wolf, he tells himself. I'll bite if I have to. Pete is in his creative writing class. The text is Strunken White's The Elements of Style, and today they are discussing the famous Rule 13, omit needless words. They have been assigned Hemingway's short story, The Killers, and it has provoked a lively class discussion. Many words are spoken on the subject of how Hemingway omits needless words. Pete barely hears any of them. He keeps looking at the clock, where the hands march steadily toward his appointment with Andrew Halliday, and he keeps going over his script. At 2:25, his phone vibrates against his leg. He slips it out and looks at the screen. "Mom, come right home after school. We need to talk." His stomach cramps, and his heart kicks into a higher gear. It might be no more than some chore that needs doing, but Pete doesn't believe it. "We need to talk," his mom speak, "for Houston, we have a problem." It could be the money. And in fact, that seems likely to him because problems come in bunches. If it is, then Tina let the cat out of the bag. All right. If that's how it is, all right. He will go home and they will talk. But he needs to resolve the Halliday business first. His parents aren't responsible for the jam he's in, and he won't make them responsible. He won't blame himself either. He did what he had to do. If Halliday refuses to cut a deal, if he calls the police in spite of the reasons Pete can give him not to, then the less his parents know, the better. He doesn't want them charged as accessories or something. He thinks about switching his phone off and decides not to. If she texts him again, or if Tina does, it's better to know. He looks up at the clock and sees it's 2:40. Soon the bell will ring, and he'll leave school. Pete wonders if he'll ever be back.
21. Hodges parks his Prius 50 feet or so down from the high school's main entrance. He's on a yellow curb, but he has an old police call card in his glove compartment, which he saves for just such parking problems. He places it on the dashboard. When the bell rings, he gets out of the car and leans against the hood with his arms folded, watching the bank of doors. Engraved above the entrance is the school's motto, "Education is the lamp of life." Hodges has his phone in one hand, ready to either make or receive a call, depending on who comes out or who doesn't. The wait isn't long, because Pete Saubers is among the first group of students to burst into the June day and come hurrying down the wide granite steps. Most of the kids are with friends. The Saubers boy is alone. Not the only one flying solo, of course, but there's a set look to his face, as if he's living in the future instead of the here and now. Hodge's eyes are as good as they ever were, and he thinks that could be the face of a soldier going into battle. Or maybe he's just worried about finals. Instead of heading toward the yellow buses parked beside the school on the left, he turns right toward where Hodges is parked. Hodges ambles to meet him, speed dialing Holly as he goes. "I've got him," tells Jerome. He cuts the call without waiting for her to answer. The boy angles to go around Hodges on the street side. Hodges steps in front of him. "Hey, Pete, got a minute?" The kid's eyes snap front and center. He's good-looking, but his face is too thin and his forehead is spotted with acne. His lips are pressed so tightly together that his mouth is almost gone.
"Who are you?"
he asks. Not "yes, sir," or "can I help you," just "who are you?" The voice is tight-wired as the face. "My name is Bill Hodges. I'd like to talk to you." Kids are passing them, chattering, elbowing, laughing, shooting the shit, adjusting backpacks. A few glance at Pete and the man with the thinning white hair, but none show any interest. They have places to go and things to do.
"About what?"
"In my car would be better, so we can have some privacy." He points at the Prius.
The boy repeats, "About what?"
He doesn't move. "Here's the deal, Pete. Your sister Tina is friends with Barbara Robinson. I've known the Robinson family for years, and Barb persuaded Tina to come and talk to me. She's very worried about you."
"Why?"
"If you're asking why Barb suggested me, it's because I used to be a police detective." Alarm flashes in the boy's eyes. "If you're asking why Tina's worried, that's something we'd really be better off not discussing on the street." Just like that, the look of alarm is gone, and the boy's face is expressionless again. It's the face of a good poker player. Hodges has questioned suspects who are able to wipe their faces like that, and they are usually the ones who are toughest to crack, if they crack at all.
"I don't know what Tina said to you, but she's got nothing to worry about."
"If what she told me is true, she might." Hodges gives Pete his best smile. "Come on, Pete, I'm not going to kidnap you. Swear to God." Pete nods reluctantly. When they reach the Prius, the kid stops dead, He's reading the yellow card on the dashboard.
Used to be a police detective or still are?
Used to be, Hodges says. That card, call it a souvenir, comes in handy sometimes. I've been off the force and collecting my pension for 5 years. Please get in so we can talk. I'm here as a friend. If we stand out here much longer, I'm going to melt.
And if I don't?
Hodges shrugs. Then you're off.
Okay, but only for a minute, Pete says. I have to walk home today so I can stop at the drugstore for my father. He takes this stuff Vioxx because he got hurt a few years ago.
Hodges nods. I know. City Center, that was my case.
Yeah?
Yeah. Pete opens the passenger door and gets into the Prius. He doesn't seem nervous about being in a strange man's car. Careful and cautious, but not nervous. Hodges, who has done roughly 10,000 suspect and witness interviews over the years, is pretty sure the boy has come to a decision, although he can't tell if it's to spill what's on his mind or keep it to himself. Either way, it won't take long to find out. He goes around and gets in behind the wheel. Pete is okay with that, but when Hodges starts the engine, he tenses up and grabs the door handle. Relax. I only want the air conditioning. It's damn hot, in case you didn't notice, especially for so early in the year. Probably global warm.
Let's get this over with so I can pick up my dad's script and go home. What did my sister tell you? You know she's only 13, right? I love her to death, but Mom calls her Tina the drama queen.
And then, as if this explains everything,
she and her friend Ellen never miss Pretty Little Liars.
Okay, so the initial decision is not to talk. Not all that surprising. The job now is to change his mind. Tell me about the cash that came in the mail, Pete. No tensing up, no uh-oh look flashing across the kid's face. He knew that was it, Hodges thinks. He knew as soon as his sister's name came up. He might even have had advance warning. Tina could have had a change of heart and texted him.
You mean the mystery money, Pete says. That's what we call it?
Yeah, that's what I mean.
It started coming 4 years ago, give or take. I was about the age Tina is now. There'd be an envelope addressed to my dad every month or so. Never any letter with it, just the money.
$500.
Once or twice, it might have been a little less or a little more, I guess. I wasn't always there when it came, and after the first couple of times, Mom and Dad didn't talk about it very much.
Like talking about it might jinx it?
Yeah, like that. And then, at some point, teens got the idea I was the one sending it. Like as if, back then, I didn't even get an allowance.
If you didn't do it, who did?
I don't know.
It seems he will stop there, but then he goes on. Hodges listens peacefully, hoping Pete will say too much. The boy is obviously intelligent, but sometimes even the intelligent ones say too much, if you let them.
You know how every Christmas they have stories on the news about some guy giving out $100 bills in Walmart or wherever?
Sure.
I think it was that type of deal. Some rich guy decided to play Secret Santa with one of the people who got hurt that day at City Center, and he picked my dad's name out of a hat. He turns to face Hodges for the first time since they got in the car, eyes wide and earnest and totally untrustworthy. For all I know, he's sending money to some of the others, too. Probably the ones who got hurt the worst and couldn't work.
Hodges thinks, that's good, kiddo. It actually makes a degree of sense. Giving out $1,000 to 10 or 20 random shoppers at Christmas is one thing. Giving well over 20 grand to one family over 4 years is something else. If you add in other families, you'd be talking about a small fortune.
He could be a hedge fund dude, Pete says. You know, one of those guys who got rich while everyone else was getting poor and felt guilty about it.
He's not looking at Hodges anymore. Now he's looking straight out of the windshield. There's an aroma coming off him, or so it seems to Hodges. Not sweat, but fatalism. Again, he thinks of soldiers preparing to go into battle, knowing the chances are at least 50-50 that they'll be killed or wounded. Listen to me, Pete. I don't care about the money.
I didn't send it.
Hodges pushes on. It's the thing he was always best at. It was a windfall, and you used it to help your folks out of a tough spot. That's not a bad thing. It's an admirable thing.
Lots of people might not think so, Pete says. If it was true, that is.
You're wrong about that. Most people would think so. And I'll tell you something you can take as 100% dead red certainty because it's based on 40 years of experience as a cop. No prosecutor in this city, no prosecutor in the whole country would try bringing charges against a kid who found some money and used it to help his family after his dad first lost his job and then got his legs crushed by a lunatic. The press would crucify a man or woman who tried to prosecute that shit. Pete is silent, but his throat is working, as if he's holding back a sob. He wants to tell, but something is holding him back. Not the money, but related to the money. Has to be. Hodges is curious about where the cash in those monthly envelopes came from. Anyone would be. But he's far more curious about what's going on with this kid now. You sent them the money.
For the last time, I didn't.
And that went smooth as silk, but then you got into some kind of jackpot. Tell me what it is, Pete. Let me help you fix it. Let me help you make it right. For a moment, the boy trembles on the brink of revelation. Then his eyes shift to his left. Hodges follows them and sees the card he put on the dashboard. It's yellow, the color of caution, the color of danger. Police call. He wishes to Christ he'd left it in the glove compartment and parked 100 yards farther down the street. Jesus Christ, he walks every day. 100 yards would have been easy.
There's nothing wrong,
Pete says. He now speaks as mechanically as the computer-generated voice that comes out of Hodges' dashboard GPS, but there's a pulse beating in his temples, and his hands are clasped tightly in his lap, and there's sweat on his face in spite of the air conditioning.
I didn't send the money. I have to get my dad's pills.
Pete, listen. Even if I was still a cop, this conversation would be inadmissible in court. You're a minor, and there's no responsible adult present to counsel you. In addition, I never gave you the words, the Miranda warning. Hodges sees the boy's face slam shut like a bank vault door. All it took was 2 words, Miranda warning.
I appreciate your concern, Pete says in that same polite robot voice. He opens the car door. But there's nothing wrong, really.
There is, though, Hodges says. He takes one of his cards from his breast pocket and holds it out. Take this. Call me if you change your mind. Whatever it is, I can help. The door closes. Hodges watches Pete Saubers walk swiftly away, puts the card back in his pocket and thinks, fuck me, I blew it. 6 years ago, maybe even 2, I would have had him. But blaming his age is too easy. A deeper part of him, more analytical and less emotional, knows he was never really close. Thinking he might have been was an illusion. Pete has geared himself up for battle so completely that he's psychologically incapable of standing down. The kid reaches City Drug, takes his father's prescription out of his back pocket and goes inside. Hodges speed dials Jerome.
Bill, how did it go?
Not so good. You know City Drug?
Sure.
He's getting a script filled there. Haul ass around the block as fast as you can. He told me he's going home, and maybe he is, but if he's not, I want to know where he does go. Do you think you can tail him? He knows my car. He won't know yours.
No prob. I'm on my way.
Less than 3 minutes later, Jerome is coming around the corner. He nips into a space just vacated by a mom picking up a couple of kids that look way too shrimpy to be in high school. Hodges pulls out, gives Jerome a wave, and heads for Holly's position on Garner Street, punching in her number as he goes. They can wait for Jerome's report together.
22. Pete's father does take Vioxx, has ever since he finally kicked the OxyContin, but he currently has plenty. The folded sheet of paper Pete takes from his back pocket and glances at before going into City Drug is a stern note from the assistant principal reminding juniors that junior skip day is a myth and the office will examine all absences that day with particular care. Pete doesn't brandish the note. Bill Hodges may be retired, but he sure didn't seem retarded. No, he just looks at it for a moment, as if making sure he has the right thing, and goes inside. He walks rapidly to the prescription counter at the back where Mr. Pelkey throws him a friendly salute.
Yo, Pete, what can I get you today?
Nothing, Mr. Pelkey. We're all fine. But there are a couple of kids after me because I wouldn't let them copy some answers from our take-home history test. I wonder if you could help me?
Mr. Pelkey frowns and starts for the swing gate. He likes Pete, who is always cheerful even though his family has gone through incredibly tough times.
Point them out to me. I'll tell them to get lost.
No, I can handle it, but tomorrow, after they have a chance to cool off. Just, you know, if I could slip out the back.
Mr. Pelkey drops a conspiratorial wink that says he was a kid once, too. Sure. Come through the gate. He leads Pete between shelves filled with salves and pills, then into the little office at the back. Here's a door with a big red sign on it reading, "Alarm will sound." Mr. Pelkey shields the code box next to it with one hand and punches in some numbers with the other. There's a buzz.
Out you go, he tells Pete.
Pete thanks him, nips out onto the loading dock behind the drugstore and jumps down to the cracked cement. An alley takes him to Frederick Street. He looks both ways for the ex-detective's Prius, doesn't see it, and breaks into a run. It takes him 20 minutes to reach Lower Main Street, and although he never spots the blue Prius, he makes a couple of sudden diversions along the way just to be safe. He's just turning onto Lacemaker Lane when his phone vibrates again. This time, the text is from his sister. Tina, did you talk to Mr. Hodges? Hope you did. Mom knows. I didn't tell. She knew. Please don't be mad at me.
As if I could, Pete thinks. Were they 2 years closer in age, maybe they could have gotten that sibling rivalry thing going, but maybe not even then. Sometimes he gets irritated with her, but really mad has never happened, even when she's being a brat.
The truth about the money is out, but maybe he can say money was all he found, and hide the fact that he tried to sell a murdered man's most private property just so his sister could go to a school where she wouldn't have to shower in a pack, and where her dumb friend Ellen would be in the rearview mirror. He knows his chances of getting out of this clean or slim approaching none, but at some point, maybe this very afternoon, watching the hands of the clock move steadily toward the hour of 3, that has become of secondary importance. What he really wants is to send the notebooks, especially the ones containing the last 2 Jimmy Gold novels, to NYU. Or maybe The New Yorker, since they published almost all of Rothstein's short stories in the 50s. And stick it to Andrew Halliday. Yes, and hard. All the way up. No way can Halliday be allowed to sell any of Rothstein's later work to some rich crackpot collector who will keep it in a climate-controlled secret room along with his Renoirs or Picassos or his precious 15th-century Bible. When he was a kid, Pete saw the notebooks only as buried treasure. His treasure. He knows better now, and not just because he's fallen in love with John Rothstein's nasty, funny, and sometimes wildly moving prose. The notebooks were never just his. They were never just Rothstein's either, no matter what he might have thought hidden away in his New Hampshire farmhouse. They deserved to be seen and read by everyone. Maybe the little landslide that exposed the trunk on that winter day had been nothing but happenstance, but Pete doesn't believe it. He believes that, like the blood of Abel, the notebooks cried out from the ground. If that makes him a dipshit romantic, so be it. Some shit does mean shit. Halfway down Lacemaker Lane, he spots the bookshop's old-fashioned scrolled sign. It's like something you might see outside an English pub, although this one reads Andrew Halliday Rare Editions instead of The Plowman's Rest or whatever. Looking at it, Pete's last doubts disappear like smoke. He thinks, John Rothstein is not your birthday fuck either, Mr. Halliday. Not now, and never was. You get none of the notebooks. Bupkis, honey, as Jimmy Gold would say. If you go to the police, I'll tell them everything, and after that business you went through with the James Agee book, we'll see who they believe. A weight, invisible but very heavy, slips from his shoulders. Something in his heart seems to have come back into true for the first time in a long time. Pete starts for Halliday's at a fast walk, unaware that his fists are clenched. 23. At a few minutes past three, around the time Pete is getting into Hodges' Prius, a customer does come into the bookshop. He's a pudgy fellow whose thick glasses and gray-flecked goatee do not disguise his resemblance to Elmer Fudd. "Can I help you?" Morris asks, although what first occurs to him is,
"What's up, Doc?"
"I don't know," Elmer says dubiously. "Where is Drew?"
"There was sort of a family emergency in Michigan." Morris knows Andy came from Michigan, so that's okay, but he'll have to be cagey about the family angle. If Andy ever talked about relatives, Morris has forgotten. "I'm an old friend. He asked if I'd mind the store this afternoon." Elmer considers this. Morris's left hand, meanwhile, creeps around to the small of his back and touches the reassuring shape of the little automatic. He doesn't want to shoot this guy, doesn't want to risk the noise, but he will if he has to. There's plenty of room for Elmer back there in Andy's private office.
"He was holding a book for me, on which I have made a deposit. A first edition of They Shoot Horses, Don't They? It's by..."
"Horace McCoy," Morris finishes for him. The books on the shelf to the left of the desk, the ones the security DVDs were hiding behind, had slips sticking out of them, and since entering the bookstore today, Morris has examined them all. They're customer orders, and the McCoy is among them. "Fine copy, signed. Flat signature, no dedication. Some foxing on the spine." Elmer smiles.
"That's the one."
Morris takes it down from the shelf, sneaking a glance at his watch as he does. 3:13. Northfield High classes end at 3, which means the boy should be here by 3:30 at the latest. He pulls the slip and sees Irving Yankovic, $750. He hands the book to Elmer with a smile. "I remember this one especially. Andy, I guess he prefers Drew these days, told me he's only going to charge you $500. He got a better deal on it than he expected and wanted to pass the savings along." Any suspicion Elmer might have felt at finding a stranger in Drew's customary spot evaporates at the prospect of saving $250. He takes out his checkbook.
"So, with a deposit, that comes to..."
Morris waves a magnanimous hand. "He neglected to tell me what the deposit was. Just deduct it. I'm sure he trusts you."
"After all these years, he certainly ought to."
Elmer bends over the counter and begins writing the check. He does this with excruciating slowness. Morris checks the clock. 3:16.
"Have you read They Shoot Horses?"
"No," Morris says. "I missed that one." What will he do if the kid comes in while this pretentious goateed asshole is still dithering over his checkbook? He won't be able to tell Saubers that Andy's in back, not after he's told Elmer Fudd he's in Michigan. Sweat begins to trickle out of his hairline and down his cheeks. He can feel it. He used to sweat like that in prison while he was waiting to be raped.
"Marvelous book,"
Elmer says, pausing with his pen poised over the half-written check.
"Marvelous noir, and a piece of social commentary to rival The Grapes of Wrath."
He pauses, thinking instead of writing, and now it's 3:18.
"Well, perhaps not grapes. That might be going too far. But it certainly rivals In Dubious Battle, which is more of a socialist tract than a novel. Don't you agree?"
Morris says he does. His hands feel numb. If he has to pull out the gun, he's apt to drop it, or shoot himself straight down the crack of his ass. That makes him yawp, a sudden laugh, a startling sound in this narrow, book-lined space. Elmer looks up, frowning.
"Something funny? About Steinbeck, perhaps?"
"Absolutely not," Morris says. I have a medical condition." He runs a hand down one damp cheek. "It makes me sweat, and then I start laughing." The look on Elmer Fudd's face makes him laugh again. He wonders if Andy and Elmer ever had sex, and the thought of that bouncing, slapping flesh makes him laugh some more. "I'm sorry, Mr. Yankovic. It's not you. And by the way, are you related to the noted popular music humorist Weird Al Yankovic?"
"No, not at all."
Yankovic scribbles his signature in a hurry, rips the check loose from his checkbook, and passes it to Morris, who is grinning and thinking that this is a scene John Rothstein could have written. During the exchange, Yankovic takes care that their fingers should not touch. "Sorry about the laughing," Morris says, laughing harder. He's remembering that they used to call the noted popular musical humorist Weird Al Yank My Dick. "I really can't control it." The clock now reads 3:21, and even that is funny. Ah!
"I understand."
Elmer is backing away with the book clutched to his chest.
"Thank you."
He hurries toward the door. Morris calls after him. "Make sure you tell Andy I gave you the discount when you see him." This makes Morris laugh harder than ever, because that's a good one.
"When you see him."
Get it? When the fit finally passes, it's 3:25, and for the first time it occurs to Morris that maybe he hurried Mr. Irving Elmer Fudd Yankovic out for no reason at all. Maybe the boy has changed his mind. Maybe he's not coming. And there's nothing funny about that. Well, Morris thinks, if he doesn't show up here, I'll just have to pay a house call. Then the joke will be on him, won't it?
24. 20 to 4. There's no need to park on a yellow curb now. The parents who clogged the area around the high school earlier, waiting to pick up their kids, have all departed. The buses are gone, too. Hodges, Holly, and Jerome are in a Mercedes sedan that once belonged to Holly's cousin Olivia. It was used as a murder weapon at City Center, but none of them is thinking about that now. They have other things in mind, chiefly Thomas Sauber's son.
"The kid may be in trouble, but you have to admit he's a quick thinker," Jerome says. After 10 minutes parked down the street from City Drug, he went inside and ascertained that the boy he was tasked to follow had departed.
"A pro couldn't have done much better."
"True," Hodges says. The boy has turned into a challenge. Certainly more of a challenge than the airplane-stealing Mr. Madden. Hodges hasn't questioned the pharmacist himself and doesn't need to. Pete's been getting prescriptions filled there for years. He knows the pharmacist, and the pharmacist knows him. The kid made up some bullshit story. The pharmacist let him use the back door, and Pop goes the weasel. They never covered Frederick Street because there seemed to be no need.
"Now what?" Jerome asks.
"I think we should go over to the Sauber's house. We had a slim chance of keeping his parents out of this per Tina's request, but I think that just went by the boards."
"They must already have some idea it was him," Jerome says. "I mean, they're his folks."
Hodges thinks of saying, "There are none so blind as those who will not see," and shrugs instead. Holly has contributed nothing to the discussion so far. Has just sat behind the wheel of her big boat of a car, arms crossed over her bosom, fingers tapping lightly at her shoulders. Now she turns to Hodges, who is sprawled in the back seat.
"Did you ask Peter about the notebook?"
"I never got a chance," Hodges says. Holly's got a bee in her hat about that notebook, and he should have asked just to satisfy her, but the truth is it never even crossed his mind. "He decided to go and boogied, wouldn't even take my card."
Holly points to the school. "I think we should talk to Ricky the hippie before we leave."
And when neither of them replies,
"Peter's house will still be there, you know. It's not going to fly away or anything."
"Guess it wouldn't hurt," Jerome says.
Hodges sighs. "And tell him what exactly? That one of his students found or stole a stack of money and doled it out to his parents like a monthly allowance? The parents should find that out before some teacher who probably doesn't know jack shit about anything. And Pete should be the one to tell them. It'll let his sister off the hook, for one thing."
"But if he's in some kind of jam he doesn't want them to know about, and he still wanted to talk to someone, you know, an adult..."
Jerome is 4 years older than he was when he helped Hodges with the Brady Hartsfield mess, old enough to vote and buy legal liquor, but still young enough to remember how it is to be 17 and suddenly realize you've gotten in over your head with something. When that happens, you want to talk to somebody who's been around the block a few times.
"Jerome's right," Holly says. She turns back to Hodges. "Let's talk to the teacher and find out if Pete asks for advice about anything. If he asks why, we want to know."
"Of course he'll want to know why," Hodges says. "And I can't exactly claim confidentiality. I'm not a lawyer."
"Or a priest," Jerome adds, not helpfully.
"You can tell him we're friends of the family," Holly says firmly. "And that's true."
She opens her door. "You have a hunch about this," Hodges says. "Am I right?"
"Yes," she says. "It's a Holly hunch. Now come on." 25.
As they are walking up the wide front steps and beneath the motto, "Education is the lamp of life," the door of Andrew Halliday Rare Editions opens again, and Pete Salbers steps inside.
He starts down the main aisle, then stops, frowning.
The man behind the desk isn't Mr. Halliday. He is in most ways the exact opposite of Mr. Halliday, pale instead of florid, except for his lips, which are weirdly red, white-haired instead of bald, and thin instead of fat, almost gaunt. Jesus. Pete expected his script to go out the window, but not this fast.
Where's Mr. Halliday? I had an appointment to see him.
The stranger smiles.
Yes, of course, although he didn't give me your name. He just said a young man. He's waiting for you in his office at the back of the shop.
This is actually true, in a way.
Just knock and go in.
Pete relaxes a little. It makes sense that Halliday wouldn't want to have such a crucial meeting out here, where anybody looking for a second-hand copy of To Kill a Mockingbird could walk in and interrupt them. He's being careful, thinking ahead. If Pete doesn't do the same, his slim chance of coming out of this okay will go out the window.
Thanks, he says, and walks between tall bookcases toward the back of the shop.
As soon as he goes by the desk, Morris rises and goes quickly and quietly to the front of the shop. He flips the sign in the door from open to closed. Then he turns the bolt.
26.
The secretary in the main office of Northfield High looks curiously at the trio of after-school visitors but asks no questions. Perhaps she assumes they are family members come to plead the case of some failing student. Whatever they are, it's Howie Ricker's problem, not hers. She checks a magnetic board covered with multicolored tags and says, "He should still be in his homeroom. That's 309 on the third floor. But please peek through the window and make sure he's not with a student. He has conferences today until 4, and with school ending in a couple of weeks, plenty of kids stop by to ask for help on their final papers or plead for extra time." Hodges thanks her, and they go up the stairs, their heels echoing. From somewhere below, a quartet of musicians is playing Greensleeves. From somewhere above, a hearty male voice cries jovially, "You suck, Malone!" Room 309 is halfway down the third floor corridor, and Mr. Ricker, dressed in an eye-burning paisley shirt with the collar unbuttoned and the tie pulled down, is talking to a girl who is gesturing dramatically with her hands. Ricker glances up, sees he has visitors, then returns his attention to the girl. The visitors stand against the wall, where posters advertise summer classes, summer workshops, summer holiday destinations, an end-of-year dance. A couple of girls come bopping down the hall, both wearing softball jerseys and caps. One is tossing a catcher's mitt from hand to hand, playing hot potato with it. Holly's phone goes off, playing an ominous handful of notes from the Jaws theme. Without slowing, one of the girls says,
"You're going to need a bigger boat."
And they both laugh. Holly looks at her phone, then puts it away.
"A text from Tina," she says.
Hodges raises his eyebrows.
"Her mother knows about the money. Her father will, too, as soon as he gets home from work."
She nods toward the closed door of Mr. Ricker's room.
"No reason to hold back now."
27.
The first thing Pete becomes aware of when he opens the door to the darkened inner office is the billowing stench. It's both metallic and organic, like steel shavings mixed with spoiled cabbage. The next thing is the sound, a low buzzing. Flies, he thinks, and although he can't see what's in there, the smell and the sound come together in his mind with a thud, like a heavy piece of furniture falling over. He turns to flee. The clerk with the red lips is standing there beneath one of the hanging globes that light the back of the store, and in his hand is a strangely jolly gun, red and black with inlaid gold curlicues. Pete's first thought is, looks fake. They never look fake in the movies.
"Keep your head, Peter," the clerk says. "Don't do anything foolish, and you won't get hurt. This is just a discussion."
Pete's second thought is, you're lying. I can see it in your eyes.
Turn around, take a step forward, and turn on the light. The switch is to the left of the door. Then go in, but don't try to slam the door unless you want a bullet in the back.
Pete steps forward. Everything inside him from the chest on down feels loose and in motion. He hopes he won't piss his pants like a baby. Probably that wouldn't be such a big deal. Surely he wouldn't be the first person to spray his jockeys when a gun is pointed at him, but it seems like a big deal. He fumbles with his left hand, finds the switch, and flips it. When he sees the thing lying on the sodden carpet, he tries to scream, but the muscles in his diaphragm aren't working, and all that comes out is a watery moan. Flies are buzzing and lighting on what remains of Mr. Halliday's face, which is not much.
I know, the clerk says sympathetically. Not very pretty, is he? Object lessons rarely are. He pissed me off, Pete. Do you want to piss me off?
No, Pete says in a high, wavering voice. It sounds more like Tina's than his own. I don't.
Then you have learned your lesson. Go on in. Move very slowly, but feel free to avoid the mess.
Pete steps in on legs he can barely feel, edging to his left along one of the bookcases, trying to keep his loafers on the part of the rug that hasn't been soaked. There isn't much. His initial panic has been replaced by a glassy sheet of terror. He keeps thinking of those red lips, keeps imagining the big bad wolf telling Red Riding Hood, "The better to kiss you with, my dear."
I have to think, he tells himself. I have to, or I'm going to die in this room. Probably I will anyway, but if I can't think, it's for sure.
He keeps skirting the blotch of blackish purple until a cherry wood sideboard blocks his path, and there he stops. To go farther would mean stepping onto the bloody part of the rug, and it might still be wet enough to squelch. On the sideboard are crystal decanters of booze and a number of squat glasses. On the desk, he sees a hatchet, its blade throwing back a reflection of the overhead light. That is surely the weapon the man with the red lips used to kill Mr. Halliday, and Pete supposes it should scare him even more, but instead the sight of it clears his mind like a hard slap. The door clicks shut behind him. The clerk, who probably isn't a clerk, leans against it, pointing the jolly little gun at Pete.
All right, he says and smiles. Now we can talk.
What?
He clears his throat, tries again, this time sounds a little more like himself.
What? Talk about what?
Don't be disingenuous. The notebooks, the ones you stole.
It all comes together in Pete's mind. His mouth falls open. The clerk who isn't a clerk smiles.
Ah, the penny drops. I see. Tell me where they are and you might get out of this alive.
Pete doesn't think so. He thinks he already knows too much for that.
28. When the girl emerges from Mr. Ricker's home room, she's smiling, so her conference must have gone all right. She even twiddles her fingers in a little wave, perhaps to all three of them, more likely just to Jerome, as she hurries off down the hall. Mr. Ricker, who has accompanied her to the door, looks at Hodges and his associates. "Can I help you, lady and gentlemen?" "Not likely," Hodges says, "but worth a try. May we come in?"
"Of course."
They sit at desks in the front row like attentive students. Ricker plants himself on the edge of his desk, an informality he eschewed when talking to his young conferee.
"I'm pretty sure you're not parents, so what's up?"
"It's about one of your students," Hodges says. "A boy named Peter Saubers. We think he may be in trouble."
Ricker frowns. "Pete? That doesn't seem likely. He's one of the best students I've ever had. Demonstrates a genuine love of literature, especially American literature. Honor roll every quarter. What kind of trouble do you think he's in?"
"That's the thing. We don't know. I asked, but he stonewalled me."
Ricker's frown deepens. "That doesn't sound like the Pete Saubers I know."
It has to do with some money he seems to have come into a few years back. I'd like to fill you in on what we know. It won't take long.
Please say it has nothing to do with drugs.
It doesn't. Ricker looks relieved.
Good. Seen too much of that, and the smart kids are just as much at risk as the dumb ones. More, in some cases. Tell me. I'll help if I can.
Hodges starts with the money that began arriving at the Saubers' house in what was almost literally the family's darkest hour. He tells Ricker about how 7 months after the monthly deliveries of mystery cash ceased, Pete began to seem stressed and unhappy. He finishes with Tina's conviction that her brother tried to get some more money, maybe from the same source the mystery cash came from, and is in his current jam as a result.
He grew a mustache,
Ricker muses when Hodges is finished.
He's in Mrs. Davis's creative writing course now, but I saw him in the hall one day and joshed him about it.
How did he take the joshing? Jerome asks.
Not sure he even heard me. He seemed to be on another planet.
But that's not uncommon with teenagers, as I'm sure you know. Especially when summer vacation's right around the corner. Holly asks,
did he ever mention a notebook to you? A moleskin?
Ricker considers it while Holly looks at him hopefully.
No, he says at last. I don't think so.
She deflates.
Did he come to you about anything? Hodges asks. Anything at all that was troubling him, no matter how minor? I raised a daughter, and I know they sometimes talk about their problems in code. Probably you know that too.
Ricker smiles. The famous friend who...
Beg pardon?
As in, I have a friend who might have gotten his girlfriend pregnant.
Or, I have a friend who knows who spray-painted anti-gay slogans on the wall in the boys' locker room.
After a couple of years on the job, every teacher knows about the famous friend who.
Jerome asks, did Pete Saubers have a friend who?
Not that I can recall. I'm very sorry. I'd help you if I could.
Holly asks in a small and not very hopeful voice.
Never a friend who kept a secret diary or maybe found some valuable information in a notebook?
Ricker shakes his head.
No, I'm really sorry. Jesus, I hate to think of Pete in trouble. He wrote one of the finest term papers I've ever gotten from a student. It was about the Jimmy Gold trilogy.
John Rothstein, Jerome says, smiling. I used to have a t-shirt that said,
don't tell me, Ricker says. Shit don't mean shit.
Actually, no. It was the one about not being anyone's birthday... present.
Ah, Ricker says, smiling. That one.
Hodges gets up. I'm more of a Michael Connelly man. Thanks for your time.
He holds out his hand. Ricker shakes it. Jerome is also getting up, but Holly remains seated.
John Rothstein, she says. He wrote that book about the kid who got fed up with his parents and ran away to New York City, right?
That was the first novel in the Gold Trilogy, yes. Pete was crazy about Rothstein. Probably still is. He may discover new heroes in college, but when he was in my class, he thought Rothstein walked on water. Have you read him?
I never have, Holly says, also getting up. But I'm a big movie fan, so I always go to a website called Deadline to read the latest Hollywood news. They had an article about how all these producers wanted to make a movie out of The Runner. Only no matter how much money they offered, he told them to go to hell.
That sounds like Rothstein, all right, Ricker says. A famous curmudgeon. Hated the movies. Claimed they were art for idiots. Sneered at the word cinema. Wrote an essay about it, I think.
Holly has brightened.
Then he got murdered, and there was no will. And they still can't make a movie because of all the legal problems.
Holly, we ought to go, Hodges says. He wants to get over to the Saubers' home. Wherever Pete is now, he'll turn up there eventually.
Okay, I guess.
She sighs. Although in her late 40s, and even with the mood levelers she takes, Holly still spends too much time on an emotional roller coaster. Now the light in her eyes is going out and she looks terribly downcast. Hodges feels bad for her, wants to tell her that even though not many hunches pan out, you shouldn't stop playing them, because the few that do pan out are pure gold. Not exactly a pearl of wisdom, but later when he has a private moment with her, he'll pass it on. Try to ease the sting a little. Thank you for your time, Mr. Ricker.
Hodges opens the door. Faintly, like music heard in a dream, comes the sound of Greensleeves.
Oh my gosh, Ricker says. Hold the phone.
They turn back to him.
Pete did come to me about something, and not so long ago. But I see so many students.
Hodges nods understandingly.
And it wasn't a big deal, no adolescent storm und Drang. It was actually a very pleasant conversation. It only came to mind now because it was about that book you mentioned, Miss Gibney. The Runner.
He smiles a little.
Pete didn't have a friend who, though. He had an uncle who.
Hodges feels a spark of something bright and hot, like a lit fuse.
What was it about Pete's uncle that made him worth discussing? Pete said the uncle had a signed first edition of The Runner. He offered it to Pete because Pete was a Rothstein fan. That was the story, anyway. Pete told me he was interested in selling it. I asked him if he was sure he wanted to part with a book signed by his literary idol, and he said he was considering it very seriously. He was hoping to help send his sister to one of the private schools. I can't remember which one.
Chapel Ridge, Holly says.
The light in her eyes has returned.
I think that's right.
Hodges walks slowly back to the desk.
Tell me, us, everything you remember about that conversation? That's really all. Except for one thing that kind of nudged my bullshit meter. He said his uncle won the book in a poker game. I remember thinking that's the kind of thing that happens in novels or movies, but rarely in real life. But of course, sometimes life does imitate art.
Hodges frames the obvious question, but Jerome gets there first.
Did he ask you about booksellers?
Yes, that's really why he came to me. He had a short list of local dealers, probably gleaned from the internet. I steered him away from one of them. Bit of a shady reputation there.
Jerome looks at Holly. Holly looks at Hodges. Hodges looks at Howard Ricker and asks the obvious follow-up question. He's locked in now, the fuse in his head burning brightly. What's the shady book dealer's name?
29. Pete sees only one chance to go on living. As long as the man with the red lips and pasty complexion doesn't know where the Rothstein notebooks are, he won't pull the trigger of the gun, which is looking less jolly all the time.
You're Mr. Halliday's partner, aren't you?
He says, not exactly looking at the corpse, it's too awful, but lifting his chin in that direction.
In cahoots with him.
Red Lips utters a brief chuckle, then does something that shocks Peter, who believed until that moment he was beyond shock. He spits on the body.
He was never my partner, although he had his chance once upon a time. Long before you were even a twinkle in your father's eye, Peter. And while I find your attempt at a diversion admirable, I must insist that we keep to the subject at hand. Where are the notebooks?
In your house? Which used to be my house, by the way.
Isn't that an interesting coinkydink?
Here's another shock.
Your? More ancient history. Never mind. Is that where they are?
No, they were for a while, but I moved them.
And should I believe that?
I think not.
Because of him, Pete again lifts his chin toward the body.
I tried to sell him some of the notebooks, and he threatened to tell the police. I had to move them.
Red Lips considers this, then gives a nod.
All right, I can see that. It fits with what he told me.
So where did you put them?
Out with it, Peter. Fess up.
We'll both feel better, especially you. If 'twere to be done, 'twere well it were done quickly. Macbeth, Act One.
Pete does not fess up. To fess up is to die. This is the man who stole the notebooks in the first place. He knows that now. Stole the notebooks and murdered John Rothstein over 30 years ago. And now he's murdered Mr. Halliday. Will he scruple at adding Pete Saubers to his list? Red Lips has no trouble reading his mind.
I don't have to kill you, you know,
Not right away, at least. I can put a bullet in your leg. If that doesn't loosen your lips, I'll put one in your balls. With those gone, a young fellow like you wouldn't have much to live for anyway, would he?
Pushed into a final corner, Pete has nothing left but the burning, helpless outrage only adolescents can feel.
You killed him! You killed John Rothstein!
Tears are welling in his eyes. They run down his cheeks in warm trickles.
The best writer of the 20th century, and you broke into his house and killed him. For money. Just for money.
Not for money, Red Lips shouts back. He sold out.
He takes a step forward, the muzzle of the gun dipping slightly.
He sent Jimmy Gold to hell and called it advertising. And by the way, who are you to be high and mighty? You tried to sell the notebooks yourself. I don't want to sell them. Maybe once when I was young and stupid, but not anymore. I want to read them. They're mine. I want to run my hand over the ink and feel the words he set down in his own hand. Thinking about that was all that kept me sane for 36 years.
He takes another step forward. Yes, and what about the money in the trunk? Did you take that too?
Of course you did. You're the thief, not me. You!
In that moment, Pete is too furious to think about escape, because this last accusation, unfair though it may be, is all too true. He simply grabs one of the liquor decanters and fires it at his tormentor as hard as he can. Red Lips isn't expecting it. He flinches, turning slightly to the right as he does so, and the bottle strikes him in the shoulder. The glass stopper comes out when it hits the carpet. The sharp and stinging odor of whiskey joins the smell of old blood. The flies buzz in an agitated cloud, their meal interrupted. Pete grabs another decanter and lunges at Red Lips with it raised like a cudgel, the gun forgotten. He trips over Halliday's sprawled legs, goes to one knee, and when Red Lips shoots, the sound in the closed room is like a flat hand clap. The bullet goes over his head almost close enough to part his hair. Pete hears it. Zzz. He throws the second decanter, and this one strikes Red Lips just below the mouth, drawing blood. He cries out, staggers backward, hits the wall. The last two decanters are behind him now, and there's no time to turn and grab another. Pete pushes to his feet and snatches the hatchet from the desk, not by the rubberized handle, but by the head. He feels the sting as the blade cuts into his palm, but it's distant, pain felt by somebody living in another country. Red Lips has held on to the gun and is bringing it around for another shot. Pete can't exactly think, but a deeper part of his mind, perhaps never called upon until today, understands that if he were closer, he could grapple with Red Lips and get the gun away from him. Easily. He's younger, stronger, but the desk is between them. So he throws the hatchet instead. It whirls at Red Lips end over end like a tomahawk. Red Lips screams and cringes away from it, raising the hand holding the gun to protect his face. The blunt side of the hatchet's head strikes his forearm. The gun flies up, strikes one of the bookcases, and clatters to the floor. There's another hand clap as it discharges. Pete doesn't know where the second bullet goes, but it's not into him, and that's all he cares about. Red Lips crawls for the gun with his fine white hair hanging in his eyes and blood dripping from his chin. He's eerily fast, somehow lizard-like. Pete calculates, still without thinking, and sees that if he races Red Lips to the gun, he'll lose. It will be close, but he will. There's a chance he might be able to grab the man's arm before he can turn the gun to fire, but not a good one. He bolts for the door instead.
Come back, you shit! Red Lips shouts. We're not done!
Coherent thought makes a brief reappearance. Oh, yes, we are, Pete thinks. He rakes the door open and goes through hunched over. He slams it shut behind him with a hard fling of his left hand and sprints for the front of the shop, toward Lacemaker Lane and the blessed lives of other people. There's another gunshot, muffled, and Pete hunches further, but there's no impact and no pain. He pulls at the front door. It doesn't open. He casts a wild glance back over his shoulder and sees Red Lips shamble out of Halliday's office, his chin wreathed in a blood goatee.
He's got the gun and he's trying to aim it. Pete paws at the thumb lock with fingers that have no feeling, manages to grasp it, and twists.
A moment later, he's on the sunny sidewalk. No one looks at him. No one is even in the immediate vicinity. On this hot weekday afternoon, the Lacemaker Lane walking mall is as close to deserted as it ever gets. Pete runs blindly, with no idea of where he's going.